World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MK-Ultra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Albarelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Albarelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot, had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
From its beginning, the promise of popular rule in the U.S. has been undermined by the power of racism, capitalism, and patriarchy, says Peter Bloom, journalist, in an article titled, "The Survival of U.S. Democracy is Under Threat." Stay tuned for more. With all that is happening in the United States and the world, it was perhaps all too easy to miss the ongoing battle for the future of U.S. democracy. Republicans have opened up new racist offenses against voter rights and are once more pushing through corrupt gerrymandering to rig elections in their favor. They're also blocking the Freedom to Vote Act that would curb systematic racist voter suppression through policies such as automatic registration at MVA, longer early voting, greater access to mail-in ballots, and fresh regulations for guaranteeing that people are not wrongly barred from voting and reducing partisan interference at the polls. It is no exaggeration to say that the very survivor of liberal democracy in the United States of America is under threat. This Republic strategy is just the latest example of a long history of repressing democracy in the United States of America. From its beginning, the promise of popular rule in the U.S. has been undermined by the power of racism, capitalism, and patriarchy. Further, so much of the nation's imperialism abroad and repression at home have been sanctioned by elected majorities. The effort to stop these Republican assaults on democracy is an attempt to preserve the bare minimum of fairness in a system designed by and for elites. Fighting them is crucial for stemming the present spread of white power and corporate rule. Yet, it is also necessary for radically expanding democracy in the future beyond its liberal limits. The overriding aim of Republicans is to maintain power through rigging democracy. This desire is perhaps most blatant in its ongoing gerrymandering strategies. Again and again, they redraw district lines to ensure maximum Republican representation. Regardless of the actual makeup of voters, this year, the new census results have provided a once-in-a-decade opportunity for many legislatures to redraw their electoral boundaries in ways that would maximize their partisan advantage. As one expert recently lamented, Republicans have control of the process in many states this year, and so far, they are maximizing their advantage whenever they can. The new lines will likely help Republicans retake control of the U.S. House next year. To be fair, Democrats are also guilty of such legislative chicanery, yet their push for the Freedom to Vote Act shows their desire to at least resign in these duplicitous practices. According to a report by the Brennan Center, if passed by Congress, the legislation would put in place the most transformative changes to the redistricting process in the country's history, including banning partisan gerrymandering, strengthening other protections for communities of color, making it easier for voters to get bad maps quickly struck down in court. The importance of passing this act, though, goes far beyond partisan policies. Gerrymandering and voter suppression laws are the last gasp to democratically protect a racist corporate status quo. The biggest fear of elites is to encourage all non-whites and working-class voters the chance to either cast a ballot against this racist political establishment or elect representatives who would actually challenge it once in power. Republicans and corporate interests backing them are ironically and tragically trying to use democracy against itself. They're seeking to justify their racist hypercapitalism through pretending it is supported by a majority of voters. It is a false perception that their regressive views are actually representative of the desires of U.S. citizens overall. The ultimate goal is to not just maintain but expand this racist capitalist oligarchy. The suppression and rigging of democracy at the ballot box is linked to the broader repression on democracy within the economic and social spheres of the United States. Right-wing political control is needed to push through an anti-worker and anti-civil rights agenda to combat calls for bottom-up change against a free market system that has rapidly increased inequality, incarceration, and imperialism. Just this year, Amazon used fundamentally broken anti-worker labor laws to defeat a vote by warehouse employees in Alabama to unionize. As these crises of racial capitalism only become more acute, so too will the need to use whatever reactionary Democrat means necessary to fight its resistance. Gerrymandering, far-right populist recalls of progressive politicians, and denying historically marginalized populations for their basic voting rights have and will be deployed by elites to decrease the democratic power of unions. Growing demands to defund the police and calls to end the overthrowing and undermining of democracy around the world by the U.S. military. Is a less publicized but a still serious danger to democracy posed by the current battle for the passage of the Freedom to Vote Act. It is to restrict the struggle for democracy to the narrow limits of liberalism. If Republicans want to actively restrict democracy to expand the power of white privilege and corporate oligarchy, status quo Democrats too often want to stop at simply preserving basic voting rights. Instead, this should be the first step in the progressive spread of democracy beyond traditional policies. It means promoting the democratic control of workplaces and community democracy initiatives such as participatory budgeting. It also entails providing global solidarity and real support for radical democratic movements challenging corporate power internationally. The battle for this act represents so much more than the defense of current democracy. It is the ongoing drive to radically expand the power of people over profits locally, nationally, and internationally. The very future of progressive democracy is under threat in the United States of America.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Deep-seated racism and Islamophobia once again resurfaced in the United States following threats and insults against Muslim House Representative Ilhan Omar. Lauren Boebert, a far-right Republican congresswoman, insulted Omar by suggesting that she was a terrorist to a crowd at her own state of Colorado. Boebert described encountering Omar at the U.S. Capitol and being relieved that she does not have a backpack, an apparent reference to Omar possibly carrying a bomb. Boebert further insulted Omar by describing her as a member of the Jihad Squad.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that this isn't new in the context of racism in America, and that America has been a racist country since its founding. I think it's important to always understand or do your analysis of this issue with that being the underlying premise.
Last week, Boebert apologized to anyone in the Muslim community that she may have offended, but refused to directly refer to Omar. Following Boebert's refusal to apologize, the Muslim Democrat congresswoman received a racist, death threat-laden voicemail left for her. In a news conference on Tuesday, Omar called on Republican leadership, who have so far declined to punish Boebert over the comments, to stand up to anti-Muslim hate. Omar, who became the first Somali-American and naturalized citizen of African birth to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives when she was elected in the year 2018, said the voicemail came through shortly after Bobart posted another video on social media on Monday. "We cannot pretend this hate speech from leading politicians does not have real consequences," she said.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, his refusal to call out Congresswoman Lauren Boebert is an example of how morally bankrupt, how ethically vacuous individuals like this are, because they're always going to make the political calculation of how their constituents are going to respond to something like this instead of being a leader in a situation like this.
The latest insults heaped against Ilhan Omar have once again revealed the toxic environment against Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many Muslims became the targets of anger and racism. Mosques were burned or destroyed, and death threats and harassment followed many Muslims in the weeks following the attacks. Hate crimes against Muslims rose over 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. But even as the country moved further from the attacks and the Muslim American population in the country grew, discrimination against this community has not waned.
And so where we are now in terms of the intra-party struggle that we're seeing, inter- and intra-party struggle, where you have Congresswoman Boebert calling Congresswoman Omar a terrorist, that now is a result of Trumpian politics.
Anti-Muslim sentiment continued during the 2016 election cycle, during which Islamophobic hate crimes surged again. It is widely believed that the rise in hate to the anti-Muslim rhetoric was linked to the political discourse espoused by the political establishment in the U.S., especially the Republican Party and the people who gathered around former U.S. President Donald Trump, who made Islam and Muslims targets of criticism throughout his presidential campaign and tenure.
It's going to continue to be incredibly divisive from a domestic perspective, and it is going to, I think, drive more and more and more white supremacist, white nationalist policy, whether it be domestic or whether it be foreign. And I also think from a domestic violence perspective, we are going to see more and more examples of individuals taking matters into their own hands, using their own firearms, and attacking fellow citizens.
During the first months of the Trump administration, it was reported that roughly 75% of Muslim American adults said that there's a lot of discrimination against Muslims in the U.S. Shortly into his time in office, Trump signed an executive order that barred immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries. Islam has been seen in the Western world in a negative light, which is fueling the wave of Islamophobic attacks on Muslims.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia, with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions, as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences. Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Last Thursday, South Africa reported cases diagnosed with a heavily mutated variant of the novel coronavirus, later named Omicron. On Monday, the World Health Organization said the new variant is expected to raise the number of infections worldwide, warning that any spike in cases could have huge consequences.
Omicron's very emergence is another reminder that although many of us might think we're done with COVID-19, it's not done with us. We're living through a cycle of panic and neglect. Hard-won gains could vanish in an instant. Our most immediate task, therefore, is to end this pandemic.
The United Nations Health Body says more studies need to be run to establish the new strain's feared resistance to vaccines and previous infections.
Well, I think that the scare value, as time goes on, of talking about these new variants of concern, falls. Now, they say in markets that you buy the rumor and you sell on the fact. Well, there's quite a few rumors circulating about this virus, but the facts that are known are very little.
Several countries scrambled to ban flights from South Africa and a number of other African countries affected by the new variant, stranding thousands of passengers there. The travel bans have drawn the ire of South Africa, with President Cyril Ramaphosa saying such moves will only cause more damage to his people.
At the same time, we need to resist unjustified as well as unscientific travel restrictions that only serve to further disadvantage developing economies.
Ramaphosa also stressed that developing countries, including those in Africa, need to manufacture their own vaccines. He called on the World Trade Organization to facilitate Africa's access to medical care. On Friday, global markets shed some $2 trillion after reports emerged suggesting that the new Omicron variant might be resistant to the existing vaccines. Although the prices recovered later on Monday, the drop exposed the vulnerability of the global economy, which is still reeling from the pandemic's aftershocks. The announcement of the new strain spread panic similar to when the pandemic first began.
Yes, the markets are riled up badly because all these rumors have started to circulate. But I believe that when people find out the facts of this variant, that the market will calm down, and hopefully it will not be used cynically by those in power to grab more authority.
In an attempt to allay the fears, U.S. President Joe Biden said the new variant is a cause for concern, but not a cause for panic.
We do not yet believe that additional measures will be needed, but so that we are prepared, if needed, my team is already working with officials at Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson to develop contingency plans for vaccines or boosters if needed.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said on Monday it was too soon to tell if Omicron will have any impact on global supply chains. But according to estimates by American investment bank Goldman Sachs, in case the Omicron variant proves deadlier and more contagious than its predecessor, Delta, the global economic growth will slow to a 2% quarter-on-quarter annual rate, that is, 2.5 percentage points below the bank's current forecast. The bank predicts that the growth in 2022 as a whole would be 4.2% or 0.4 percentage points below its forecast. Yet the new variant has already made its impact and is expected to influence consumer and corporate confidence ahead of the holiday season. That won't be a good sign for what we can expect in the months to come.
Economic Cooperation Organization, or ECCO, is an intergovernmental organization that seeks sustainable economic development of its member states and the region as a whole. Currently, 10 countries, including Iran, Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Turkey, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, are members of the organization. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi attended the 15th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization in Turkmenistan. Addressing the one-day summit on Sunday, he assured Iran's neighbors that U.S. sanctions will not hamper regional cooperation and interaction.
The United States' cruel sanctions against Iran will not have the slightest impact on the Islamic Republic of Iran's policy of maximum interaction with neighboring and regional countries.
Raisi called on member states to collaborate in a range of fields, from the creation of a regional electricity market to water transfer projects as well as energy ventures. He also proposed creating an internal financial mechanism by the Economic Cooperation Organization to boost its efficacy. On the sidelines of the summit, Raisi held a string of high-level bilateral meetings to discuss ways to develop relations. The Iranian president has time and again stated that boosting cooperation with neighboring countries is one of the main goals of his administration that will help improve the economy as well as peace and stability in the region. Iran took a big step in this regard in September, when it formally became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a Eurasian political, economic, and security alliance accounting for about one-third of the world's land and exporting trillions of dollars in goods annually. Recently, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister, Ali Bagherikani, traveled to several regional countries, including Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, for talks on expanding bilateral cooperation. This month, he also went to four European countries, namely France, Germany, Britain, and Spain, where similar talks took place. Bagherikani's European tours came ahead of a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The core issue for Tehran is the removal of the sanctions. Those sanctions took effect after the U.S. left the nuclear deal unilaterally in 2018 as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign, seen as an attempt to isolate Iran in the international arena.
The Americans intend to make Iranians suffer as much as possible so that they can get extra concessions from Iran. But Iran has been able to make progress in many areas despite the U.S. sanctions, and the economy is adjusting despite the hardship.
More than 3 years after its implementation, it seems that Washington's maximum pressure campaign has failed, with Iran expanding ties with countries in the region and beyond. Economic sanctions have been Washington's foreign policy tool of choice for years. The U.S. usually uses crippling economic sanctions to pressure other nations into succumbing to its demands. The U.S. maximum pressure campaign sought to squeeze the Iranian economy on the theory that crippling sanctions will force Tehran to choose between its own economic viability and its nuclear activities. However, despite the economic pain from sanctions, Tehran didn't concede. Speaking on a television show in July, U.S. Special Envoy to Iran, Robert Malley, admitted that the maximum pressure campaign against Tehran has failed miserably and hurt U.S. interests. Malley also acknowledged that Tehran's nuclear program accelerated only after the former U.S. President Donald Trump launched the maximum pressure campaign.
The economy is adjusting, and Iran is expanding relations. It's expanding its exports. It's producing more inside the country. And the policy of this government is to create a stronger bond between Iran and neighboring countries. And neighboring countries in particular are important for Iran with regards to trade.
Addressing the 15th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi assured that Washington's sanctions will have no bearing on regional cooperation and interaction. In fact, the ECHO bloc, along with the ESCO and other organizations like BRICS, show that if countries collaborate, world trade can occur without the presence of the U.S.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
الله اکبر
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of the academic elite in making scientific discoveries. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country. And the next step is to pursue a new Islamic civilization. Certainly, one of the most important foundations of any civilization is science, beneficial science, that is. And when we keep speaking about a new Islamic civilization, we should know that one of the foundations of any civilization is scientific progress. We must prepare ourselves for this. If your eyes are set on this horizon, you, as one of the academic elite, your scientific movement will naturally move in the right direction. And the problems that are sometimes brought up, such as the issue of scientific articles, as mentioned by the friends in the meeting, will be solved. That is, the right direction will be clear and the right progress will be made.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As for the point that I said I would expand on, it concerns scientific discoveries. This is important. Many scientific activities are taking place in the country today, but these activities are often the byproducts of the scientific creation of others. For instance, someone discovered nuclear energy, and we are working on it today. What is needed and should be pursued is the creation of science. You have to be creative. You have to produce science. And this often happens as a result of discovering a certain force in nature. That is, innovation in science results from discovering a valuable law that exists in nature and that has not been discovered to this day. On the basis of this law, science is produced and many technologies are created. We must pursue this. Our outstanding youth must pursue this creativity in science. For example, there was gravity. These are common old examples that I have been using for a long time. Someone discovered this, and science was created based on it. There was the power of electricity in nature, but no one knew about it until someone discovered it. Based on this discovery, this vast field of science and technology was created. The same is true of new sciences such as nanotechnology, stem cells, and nuclear energy. The discovery of a truth in nature, of a tradition, a valuable law or an element in the nature and science created by God can help you to realize a scientific point.
You've done for me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Following a meeting with the signatories of the nuclear agreement, known as the JCPOA, Iran calls for a reasonable, documented and rational response to its proposals for the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to full compliance. Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani said Britain, France and Germany were not happy with some of Iran's proposals.
They had no complaint about these proposals being irrelevant, but they say they are not consistent with our viewpoints, and I told them this is natural. We are not supposed to express ideas that are in line with your viewpoints. We take our own interests and policies into consideration. The important point is that they are based on principles that all sides agree on. No European side claim that Iran's proposals lack legal basis.
A diplomatic source close to the Iranian negotiating team said the country's proposed drafts were in complete conformity with the JCPOA, adding it was regrettable that some European sides were attempting to dictate their own demands round the negotiating table, while failing to acknowledge that a revival of the deal requires compliance by all sides.
I think the current administration, what it is saying is that the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, good or bad, is something that Iran's accepted, and we will commit ourselves to it. However, we will not allow the other side to retain sanctions, maximum pressure sanctions, and then expect us to go back to 2015. That simply won't happen.
EU coordinator Enrique Mora said there were substantial challenges ahead, while time to reach an agreement was not unlimited. While Iran is calling for a rational and documented response to its proposals, European diplomats are expressing concern and skepticism. The Vienna talks are set to resume next week, when it may become more clear whether the gaps can be bridged. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
The story of how Palestine was wrenched from the indigenous people lives on. It is passed down from chest to chest, from generation to generation. Even Palestinians born outside their homeland and raised in refugee camps or elsewhere carry the story with them. Attendees at this art exhibition say living in the UK, it's even more important to show up.
I think here in Britain, given Britain's role in creating the situation for Palestinian people and its ongoing support for the Israeli government and allowing it to carry out its apartheid policies, we have a special duty here to raise awareness about the situation, to fight our government when it supplies weapons to the Israeli government and gives it its support.
I support the struggle completely. And I love the forthright strength, the mood of the Palestinian people is inspiration to anybody. Anybody with any trouble, go to Palestine and see what trouble really is.
The elderly carry the keys to their demolished houses round their necks, and the new generation educate their children on the 1948 land grab that forced out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. This art exhibition in London is part of their ongoing struggle to raise the flag for Palestine.
I'm here today to celebrate our Palestinian culture, our amazing Palestinian artists. You know, our people are talented, clearly, and it's so nice to see them use their talents to preserve our culture.
This exhibition is called Visualizing Return. It launched on the anniversary of UN Resolution 194, which calls for the immediate return of all Palestinian refugees. Visualizing Return hopes to emphasize the necessity of granting Palestinian refugees this long overdue human right.
Interestingly enough, one of the easiest citizenships to acquire is Israeli citizenship. All you have to do is to prove that you have a Jewish grandparent or a Jewish spouse. But there is a Palestinian diaspora 6 million strong, and they are not not allowed to return to their homeland.
The Israeli regime wants to maintain a Jewish majority. If the diaspora were allowed to return, they would by far outnumber the Jewish population. So 73 years into occupation, the demographic war rages on. Exiled Palestinians are raising awareness, but on the front line of this struggle are the men, women and children holed up in the largest open-air prison in the world, the Gaza Strip. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In its latest annual report, Italy's Center for Social Studies and Policies, Chances, has found that some 2 million Italian families were in absolute poverty in 2020, a rise of more than 100% on 2010. This is due to the outbreak of COVID-19 that has accentuated a sense of vulnerability in the country. Census report shows that over 40% of Italians feel insecure, while students suffer increasing levels of depression, anxiety and existential angst.
The COVID-19 pandemic has made more workers vulnerable to pay discrimination, loss of income and exploitative practices. The socioeconomic malaise, which was already worrying before the pandemic, is today very much widespread to all layers of the population.
The company we work for refuses to meet us to discuss the terms of our contract as the pandemic is completely changing the way we work. This is unacceptable.
Over the past months, hundreds of large and smaller protests have been staged across Italy with workers from both the public and private sectors expressing deep concern over their deteriorating rights situation. On Friday in Rome, employees from Sogei, the information and communication technology company of the Ministry of the Economy and Finance, held a demonstration demanding to negotiate new smart working guidelines with the employer. Also on Friday, farmers from an area north of Naples staged a protest near the Agriculture Ministry calling the government for financial assistance. Hundreds of small farming companies have gone bankrupt as the large-scale retail trade has preempted small entrepreneurs.
We haven't been allowed to be here in big numbers due to the COVID restrictions. The government must help us. We are asked to observe the most stringent food regulations when it comes to our products, but fruit and vegetables full of pesticides coming from Morocco and other countries are let in without controls. Furthermore, we haven't received a penny from the EU aid funds to farmers. When the money lands into the regional government's account, it simply disappears.
On Friday, Rome and Milan were both affected by a public transport four-hour strike called by the General Union of Labour, UGL. The nationwide action was called by unionists against the obligation for workers to have the Green Pass, a certificate proving the holder has been vaccinated, tested negative or recovered from COVID-19. Max Civili, Rome.
Abdullah Al-Ghamdi is a Saudi rights campaigner living thousands of miles away from home. But even here, he isn't safe from tactics used by the Saudi regime to silent dissenters.
They attack my mom and my little brother in Jeddah. In the same time, they attack my father and another brother in Dammam. My brother in Dammam, they take him for 3 years. Nobody know where is he. But after three weeks. After 3 weeks, they release him, but they ask him to talk about me.
Abdullah and fellow rights campaigners are trustees of London-based human rights organization Sana'at. Here at a press conference ahead of releasing their first report on Saudi rights abuses titled I Fear for My Mother, compatriot Fahd Al-Ghawaidi has experienced the heavy hand of the Saudi regime more than once.
Believe it or not, I was selling books on the street. And the Saudi regime back then was, until now, he was, the knowledge is forbidden for the people in Saudi Arabia.
Another dissident had an entirely different experience. Journalist Jamal Khashoggi, killed at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey in 2018 to send a chilling message. Yet these campaigners say the murder has redoubled their resolve.
Jamal Khashoggi is dead now, but the idea of Jamal Khashoggi is still alive and it will be alive and remembered in our minds and in our heart forever.
The activists here say that the hopes of real reform in Saudi Arabia under the current regime are slim. that what is needed is real radical change, a revolution. And that's exactly what the current regime in Saudi Arabia cannot stomach.
They also believe the royals of Riyadh would not be